Recently, I saw a tweet from Patrick Miller, who rides for the Gospel Coalition, and he was making the case for preferred pronouns. Suffice it to say that it was ludicrous, but I bring this up to make a point. Things are much darker than they seem, and this is a man and organization who has fallen under the spell, and we must not give our loyalty to those who have fallen under the dark enchantment. Language and words matter, and that's why there is a war for it. Welcome to the first episode of The Narnian. I'm your host, Josh Robinson, and today I'm going to be reading an essay that I wrote for my Substack called The Dark Enchantment of Modernity, Reenchanting Cosmic Imagery, Language, and Ethics. So here we go. We'll go ahead and dive right in. Introduction. I've recently been thumbing through Jason Baxter's The Medieval Mind of C.S. Lewis. At some point last year, I heard an interview that Baxter did with the Theology Podcast and was intrigued, so I decided to pick up a copy of his book. Let me say, I have not been disappointed. It is the first book that I've had the chance to read this year, and I suspect that it will be one of the best. It is worthy of being on your bookshelves. Many readers know C.S. Lewis as Mythmaker with the Chronicles of Narnia and with the Ransom Trilogy. Others know him as a theologian and an apologist with Mere Christianity and the Problem of Pain. But few know him for his scholarly work as a professor of medieval and Renaissance literature. This is what Baxter's book is about, showing us how the great books of that age shaped the great mind of C.S. Lewis. I think for those who read this book rightly, they'll receive not just an understanding of Lewis as a professor of medieval and Renaissance literature, but a kind of counterspell to the dark enchantment of modernity. A dark enchantment that is weaving a world that is hostile towards Christian cosmology and is ill-suited to Christian spirituality. It will also reaffirm what many have said for a while now. We are currently in a war for the dictionary. And the reason why we are in a war for the dictionary is that the powers that be understand that words create worlds. Whoever controls language and stories can shape the world however they desire, including the way people view God, themselves, and their ethics. Cosmic imagery, language, and ethics. Now, I'm not the only person to see that there is a connection between language and ethics. In the chapter, Evil Enchantment, Baxter picks up a discussion on Lewis's love for languages and how language can affect ethics. He writes, "Both language and ethics are connected to our cosmic imagery. Our speech makes up a linguistic microcosm, the medium through which we describe our hopes, fears, dreams, and ambitions. And as such, it absorbs and reflects the atmosphere of the world in which it is shaped. The difference between linguistic styles from age to age are of interest precisely because we carry our world about within our language. Languages are subworlds, sharing similar deep structures to the universe in which they are native. Different languages vary in tone and rhythm, and the very feel of every sentence possessing their own personalities, made up of unique syntaxes, vocabularies, and rhetorical styles. A language has its own personality. It implies an outlook, reveals a mental activity, and has a resonance not quite the same as any other. The uniqueness of language is due, in part, to the world picture that serves as the habitat in which the language is born, develops, and adapts. The cosmos gets into the language, like rainwater seeps into a subterranean aquifer and regulates the height of the water table. Because of this connection between language and world picture, what I have been calling cosmic imagery, Not only should we expect language to change from age to age, but we should also expect that on the side of the Great Divide, the fundamental rupture in history that rendered modern society radically different from any other epoch in human history, the linguistic world that we live in is ill-suited to spiritual desire. At first glance, Baxter's point may come off as a little abstract to some readers, but it can be summed up like this. Languages and ethics are born from a culture's cosmic imagery or world picture. To use an analogy to give some earthiness to his point, you ought to think about the relationship between these things in this way. These things share something similar to a womb and child relationship. In the same way that a mother's womb gives life, nourishment, and body to its child, cosmic imagery or world picture does the same thing with language and ethics. Language takes meaning from cosmic imagery and gives body to it like a local habitation. A culture's cosmic imagery is embodied within its languages, and then these languages are used in the world to enact ethics. Just think about the cosmic imagery of Christianity for a moment. This world picture teaches us that the transcendent and immanent Most High God created the heavens and the earth. And then he created male and female with the capability of being fruitful and multiplying, Genesis 1:27-28. In this story, God gives Adam ethics born from this cosmic imagery to be embodied in the world. Eat from these trees and not from that tree. Adam then repeats this pattern by giving Eve seed, and then Eve gives body to the seed by producing offspring. The seed goes out into the world, takes dominion, and repeats this pattern, and is to enact God-glorifying ethics in the world based off of this world picture. For centuries, the ethics of many countries were shaped by this cosmic imagery. In medieval Europe, and even into the Reformation era, there were sumptuary, blasphemy, and heresy laws. For hundreds of years, America's ethics even reflected this cosmic imagery in that those who were male and female were the only ones who could be united together in marriage, and only male and female could have children. It wasn't until 2015 that same-sex couples were able to be joined together in marriage, and it wasn't until 1997 that same-sex couples were legally able to adopt children. It wasn't until the rise of modernity that this cosmic imagery was cast off, which has now affected our language and our ethics. The Dark Enchantment. Now, the question we must ask is what happens when we begin to inhabit a world that has a different cosmic imagery? What would that world look like? Baxter notes in his book that it is entirely possible for a culture to become blind to moral responsibility and to lose its sense of courage as a result of change in cosmic imagery. The culture, as a result, becomes trapped within its own way of speaking. Wendell Berry was onto this reality back in 1979 in his analysis of an official report on the Three Mile Island crisis. He noted that the report was disturbing because the language within the document was marked with an inability to admit what it is talking about. Because these specialists have routinely eliminated themselves as such, as representative human beings for consideration, they are unable to bring themselves to acknowledge to each, much less to the public, that their problem involved an extreme danger to a lot of people. This is what happens when there is a change in cosmic imagery. Language and ethics are naturally affected in the same way that the child in the womb of an unwell mother is affected. To present one more example of this, this is why we now have new language and ethics in regards to birthing persons and pregnant people. The modern project is nothing less than the casting off of the old cosmos. It is the destruction of the old cathedral. In the new cosmic imagery of modernity, there's an androgynous God somewhere up there, and all he wants is for people to be happy. He doesn't tell them how to be happy. He lets them define that for themselves. And this is the world that is going to be assumed by our children's children. Countering the Dark Enchantment. So then, how are we to break this dark enchantment? Can it be broken at this point? Indeed, I believe that it can, and C.S. Lewis thought so too. In The Weight of Glory, he talked about the need of a powerful counterspell to wake us up from the evil enchantment of worldliness. He said it this way, Do you think that I'm trying to weave a spell? Perhaps I am, but remember your fairy tales. Spells are used for breaking enchantments as well as for inducing them. And you and I need the strongest spell that can be found to wake us from the evil enchantment of worldliness which has been laid upon us for nearly 100 years. God promises to honor those who honor Him, and to disdain those who disdain Him, 1 Samuel 2:30. I believe the counterspell that we need is remaining faithful to and retrieving the cosmic imagery of Christianity and the language and ethics of Christendom. But what does this look like at the practical level? First, it's going to require that we recognize the signs of the times and fashion for ourselves new loyalties. I agree with Aaron Wren that we are living in a negative world. However, I would diagnose the problem as much worse than that. We are living in a darkly enchanted world. At this point, it's not even that the think tanks, pastors, and seminaries that were faithful a decade or two ago are trying to be winsome as much as they have been baptized into the waters of dark enchantment. Recently, I saw a tweet from Patrick Miller, who writes for the Gospel Coalition, and he was making the case for preferred pronouns. Suffice it to say that it was ludicrous, but I bring this up to make a point. Things are much darker than they seem. And this is a man, an organization, who has fallen under the spell, and we must not give our loyalty to those who have fallen under the dark enchantment. I mentioned above that there's a war for the dictionary. Language and words matter, and that's why there is a war for it. So, don't be on the wrong side of that war. Second, it's going to require a retrieval of the classical world picture. We must live within our own particular world picture as Christians. We must be loyal to that story, and it's also a good idea to apprentice ourselves to those throughout history who've done the same. To use another analogy, we must, like Gandalf in the Fellowship of the Ring, ride the old paths into the great library of Minas Tirith. We must retrieve and sit in front of those old parchments that contain the stories of the old world. We must immerse ourselves in the ancient glory. Take up Augustine, Dionysius the Areopagite, Maximus the Confessor, Gregory of Nyssa, Thomas Aquinas, Dante. Take up the classics and don't just look at the beam, but see along the beam and let their world picture become your world picture. Also, take your family with you so they can learn to see along the beam too. Baxter himself takes up this point, talking about that Lewis viewed Dante, especially his Paradiso, as a counterspell to modernity. He writes, "Dante could teach modern writers how to cast those spells used for breaking enchantments," as he would put it in his Weight of Glory sermon. Dante taught him how an artist could cast a counterspell in which the good feels weighty and attractive, a spell to overcome the evil enchantment cast by modernity. This isn't all that dissimilar from what Rod Dreher recommends in his critically acclaimed book, The Benedict Option. However, as a postmillennial Protestant, I'm a bit more optimistic than Dreher is, so I would call this approach something like the Inklings option. We are to draw lines in the sand and immerse ourselves in the great tradition, but we're not doing it to build Christian ghettos. Rather, we're doing it as a counterspell to break the dark enchantment of modernity.
And to re-enchant the cosmos once more.